This is special coverage of the governor's State of the State and Budget Address. We are broadcasting live from the Illinois State Capitol Building, where any minute now, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is expected to deliver his eighth such speech. He'll be giving it to a joint session of the Illinois General Assembly in Springfield. We are watching now for the governor to enter the House of Representatives. The special session is convening. Lawmakers are being told to take their seats. We have House Speaker Chris Welch standing at the podium, as well as the Illinois Senate President Don Harmon. And with this time, we are waiting for the governor to make his entrance into the chamber. Joining us before and after the speech to talk through what we are expecting to hear are two experts on Illinois government, politics, and state finances. Brian Gaines is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Paula Worthington is senior policy advisor at the Civic Federation and lecturer at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. Thank you both for being with us. Paula, for listeners who are just joining us, can you just briefly outline the fiscal state of Illinois? What sort of, we saw a $2.2 billion deficit number being thrown around in state government budget circles not long ago. Talk broadly about the situation of Illinois heading into this speech.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. So that estimate of $2.2 billion is a bit old. It was a few months back, and it reflected the governor's office best estimates of the impact of the slowing economy and a particularly federal income tax changes driven by H.R. 1, which would have implications for the state's own income tax collections.
H.R. 1, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Report from the fall, the Office of Management and Budget laid out all the factors there. It really wasn't a spending story. It was a revenue story. And so for the current year, fine, but for next year, it was going to be about the revenues. I'm looking to hear what the governor has to say. Part of the good news is that the recent core revenues for the state have really been performing pretty well as we're entering the second half of our current fiscal year, and that puts us in a good place as we think about entering fiscal year 2027.
We are still waiting for the governor to enter the Illinois House chamber. Currently, they are acknowledging the distinguished guests, Attorney General Kwame Raoul, State Treasurer Alexi Janulius, Comptroller Susana Mendoza, and others I should have said Secretary of State Alexi Janulius, Comptroller Susana Mendoza, and Treasurer Mike Frerichs, as well as members of the Illinois Supreme Court, still waiting on the governor to make his entrance into the chamber. Brian Gaines at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, this speech is, you know, everybody pays attention to the State of the Union, or at least many people do. I think that it's a little harder to break through the consciousness of people about state government. Can you talk about the job that governors need to try to do in these speeches, in one of these rare opportunities to, you know, try and connect directly with Illinois voters?
Yeah, I think that they're, for the most part, not connecting directly with the voters. They know that the attention is relatively low, that for a budget speech, there are a lot of people who have a personal interest and are we watching closely and parsing the words very carefully. But the average person won't be listening. They might hear something second or third hand. So the goal partly is making a series of technical points for experts, and then insofar as they're thinking for public opinion, I think that's where the sort of soaring rhetoric and general positioning about, I think we'll hear a lot about responsibility and the claims that the budget's balanced, which maybe is at least a fib. But that sort of thing, even that is more above an indirect communication. There's a tone they want to set that will make its way down to the public, but they know very well that even presidential State of the Union addresses have trouble crowding out all of the more interesting entertainment options people have, and that the general public is not watching closely. That's one of the reasons it's the middle of the day.
And what sort of things are you expecting to hear from the governor this time around, based on some of the preview coverage we've seen him? You know, he's expected to point the finger of blame, I guess, at the Trump administration in Washington.
Trump administration is an excellent foil. I think we'll hear a lot, and we could discuss at length that some of it's true, some of it's not really true about the state's fiscal problems, but they'll be the number one villain. And I think he will be positioning himself as someone who is digging the state out of a hole. And again, we could have a lot of long discussion of whether that's accurate or not. The pension liability is still disastrous. We're still in the worst place, as of the summer, at least, the state with the worst situation. But I think he would want to portray this as fixing problems that he inherited, and he's doing so, and demonstrating good governance, and all of that with a mind to someone who's probably thinking hard about running for president and not just staying in his job as governor.
Paula Worthington, we heard I expect we will hear the governor say this is his eighth balanced budget that he's introduced. And we heard Brian Gaines there just use the word fib. I wonder what you think of that assessment, more so of what the governor has says, claiming that he's introduced balanced budgets throughout his tenure.
Sure. As has been hinted at before this address segment and then even just now, the state's fiscal condition is not just reflected in the operating budget or the general fund's budget, but there's a much bigger budget that the whole state is engaged with, and that includes all kinds of other components. And when you look at things like that, when you look at the growth in spending and revenues over the last few years, I think what you can see is even when you do it in real terms, you definitely see the COVID era impact on spending and revenues. What you don't see is yet any material improvements in our unfunded pension liabilities. We've sort of plateaued in that regard at this time, and we can talk more about that, and I think we probably should, given that the governor may emphasize his own proposal to reform pensions.
I think we should as well, but we may have to hold off on that because the governor is approaching. He's now entered the House chamber. He's shaking hands with members of the General Assembly. His wife, M.K. Pritzker, is with him. And now he's making his way towards the podium. We expect his speech will be beginning soon. Let's take a little listen to what we can hear in the House chamber. Or maybe they have their microphones cut there, as they sometimes do when someone is not actively speaking. He's going around shaking the hands of, looks like some of his cabinet members, members of the Supreme Court. And now he finally appears to be approaching the podium. Hopefully we will have his microphone turned on in a moment here. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker for his State of the State of the Address. Speaker of the House and the Senate President shaking their hands and stepping up to the microphone. I'm going to go to the next slide.
I'm cooler heads at 1600 pencil.
We can go to the official
Those results were driven in part by the passion and the dedication of the record high number of teachers employed in our state this year. Our teacher vacancy grant program has invested $120 million to help school districts recruit and retain educators. Because of those remarkable results and because of our commitment to building on what works, I'm proud to say that we are extending the program for a fourth year. Year after year, this legislative body has come together to solve generational challenges through even the most difficult years, including the recent passage of monumental legislation to build a world-class transit system and incentivizing new energy sources to make electricity more affordable. In this spring legislative session, we will need to harness the same ingenuity, urgency, and commitment to overcome obstacles that would otherwise hinder real fiscal progress for the state. In that spirit, today I am proud to once again present you with a balanced budget proposal. Seven times now, I have promised to propose and sign a balanced budget, and seven times I have delivered on that promise. This year will be no different, despite how challenging this eighth year's budget is. Prudence demanded that this year's budget proposal seeks a discretionary spending increase that is less than 0.5%. It levels off and, in some cases, reduces programs that are important to me, some of which were proposals of my own. But I believe that the imperative of responsible governance and overcoming the fiscal irresponsibility of past decades must come ahead of the interests of any one politician, of any one program, or any one party. That doesn't mean that we can't make transformative progress. We won't let headwinds from Washington stop us from addressing the fact that Illinoisans, like Americans everywhere, are still paying too much for groceries, too much for housing, too much for electricity, too much to live. Everything is just too damned expensive. And that's why now, more than ever, we must work together to make life more affordable for Illinois' working families. I propose an agenda to address the high cost of living that makes life easier for the middle class and those striving to get there. Let's start with housing. The problem is clear. Rent is too high, and home ownership is too far out of reach. The cause is clear, too. We are not building enough homes fast enough. The Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois issued a report last summer showing that we will need to build 227,000 more homes by 2030 to keep up with demand. In many places, local regulations have made it too difficult and costly to build new housing. Some of the rules even have shameful roots that go back to the days of redlining. Often the problem is a failure to modernize and keep up with the changing times that we live in. It all adds up to bureaucratic red tape that unnecessarily increases costs, delays construction, and frequently kills projects altogether. For example, local parking mandates often require a uniform number, minimum number, of spaces for every new build, even in places where people don't have cars because they have ample public transit and available street parking. Unused parking spots add millions of dollars in costs and severely limit the number of new units that can be built affordably. Spaces for cars are being prioritized over spaces for people. The great news is we have developers ready to build homes, and we have Illinoisans who need them. And it doesn't get done because of these regulations. It's on us to help fix it. Today, I'm proud to announce the Building Up Illinois Developments, or BUILD, plan, an initiative to lower housing costs by making it easier, faster, and more effective to build homes in Illinois. This is an ambitious slate of reforms designed to eliminate unnecessary barriers and lower costs for housing construction, produce a wider range of family-friendly housing types, and streamline construction processes. We will enable more unused housing units to be redeveloped and put them into service. City by city, town by town, neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block, a little more housing in each area can significantly advance our housing stock. We'll add to that a robust approach to closing financing gaps for developing housing of all kinds, from targeted funds for smaller projects to direct support to local communities so that they can clear initial hurdles and make housing sites build ready. Focusing on affordable housing, the Next Generation Capacity Building Initiative is designed to provide capital, training, and technical resources to allow more affordable housing developers to access low-income tax credits in diverse communities. Removing barriers for home builders will attract responsible developers to build in places that they've been unwilling to build in so far. Reduced regulation, greater financing options, a wider range of smaller units made available for rent. We can add hundreds of thousands of homes in Illinois with this creative approach. Illinois is up to the task, but it has to start now, here, and with us. Now, affording to have a home is one thing. Affording to live in it is quite another. Electricity bills are eating up more and more of household budgets across the country, and that's got to stop. We are fortunate in Illinois. With the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, we created an energy credit program that is putting money back into the pockets of Illinois consumers. That means this year, families will receive $803 million in credits on their electricity bills. That's on top of the $1.3 billion in credits CEJA has already provided. Over the long run, bringing down electricity bills requires producing and delivering more energy for Illinois' homes and businesses. But let's not ignore the fact that lowering electricity prices is truly a multifaceted challenge. We need to think critically about our future energy usage, with the needs of Illinois households at the forefront. So, in the face of rising demand and surging prices, I'm proposing a two-year pause on authorization of new data center tax credits. With the shifting energy landscape, it is imperative that our growth does not undermine affordability and stability for our families. Region that our Northern Illinois grid operator, PJM, has moved too slowly to bring online. So together with a bipartisan coalition of all 13 governors in the PJM region, I demanded that they speed it up, and now they are. We also got a price cap from PJM that will save consumers across the region $45 billion through the year 2030. Finally, PJM must force data center developers to pay their capacity for their own capacity resources to power their operations to protect consumers from higher rates. Similarly, our Central and Southern Illinois grid operator, MISO, has a long waiting list of projects, and they have agreed to bring those projects online. Together, this will massively increase available power for Illinois homes and businesses. But our work to lower energy prices can't stop with PJM and MISO. Illinois is already number one in clean nuclear energy production. That is a leadership mantle that we must hold on to. Producing even more energy is vital to keep up with increasing demand and bring down prices. A few months ago, the General Assembly passed and I signed the Clean and Reliable Grid Affordability Act, which lifts a decades-long moratorium on new nuclear power in Illinois. And that opened up the possibility and the door for construction of new modern reactors that can help us keep our clean energy leadership and create new jobs. And with CEJA already in place, many of those jobs and contracts will go to people from communities that previously never had the opportunity to benefit from the energy sector. The economic opportunity of building new clean power is enormous. So today, I've issued an executive order designed to speed up building new clean nuclear power so that we can increase our electricity supply and secure our energy future. We can take years off of the development and launch of new baseload energy production. It sets a new nuclear energy framework for Illinois, one that prioritizes affordability, safety, and reliability. Our state agencies have been ordered to immediately begin working together and reaching out to local governments to identify sites for new reactors. It will also advance the development of a state regulatory framework with rigorous safety and siting standards. My goal is delivering at least 2 gigawatts of new clean nuclear capacity in our state, enough to power up to 2 million Illinois homes. For Illinois households and businesses, expanded supply will make electricity less expensive, more reliable, and clean, while creating thousands of jobs and maintaining our state's status as a net energy exporter. As we tackle the high costs Illinois families are paying for energy and housing. We also need to focus on the unaffordability of health care. A car accident, a cancer diagnosis, a life-threatening disease. Getting treated and getting well shouldn't be a lifelong burden on your finances and credit score. 2 years ago, the state of Illinois launched our historic medical debt relief program to unburden working families who are sinking under the weight of overdue bills from an unexpected illness. Today, I'm proud to announce that as of this week, we have negotiated the elimination of $1 billion in medical debt for 520,000 Illinoisans across all 102 counties. We're providing immediate financial relief, and we're doing it for pennies on the dollar. I've proposed we continue this program this coming budget year. Fighting for working families means attacking the bills that weigh people down in their everyday lives. The cost of healthcare in this country is ridiculously high, and while President Trump's budget makes it even more expensive, Illinois is standing up to protect its people. Another way to make life more affordable is by helping Illinoisans earn more. And one of the most important determinants of earnings is getting a good education. It leads to good-paying jobs. Never has getting a post-secondary degree been more important, but it's historically been too damned expensive. And that's why the majority in the General Assembly has worked with me since day one to make college a realistic and more affordable pathway for all Illinoisans. How's it going? Illinois now has the second highest percentage of people with a bachelor's degree among the nation's top 10 most populous states, beating out states like California and Texas and Florida. Our public university enrollment has reached a 10-year high, and today, the number of Illinois students attending our public universities tuition-free has reached an all-time high of 44%. Similarly, our community colleges have surpassed the 2019 fall student count and have seen steadily rising enrollments. Along with vocational training in high schools, this is vital to our future. Attracting major job creators requires sustained investments in our most valuable resource, our people. We have built a pipeline of qualified workers with the skills and training to fill the high-growth sectors of the future, but we still need more. That is a path to a better life that should be available to every Illinoisan and that doesn't require a university degree. I propose we create a vocational training grant program, which will provide school districts and regional vocational centers with support to build and expand specialized workforce programs, like the proposed Southland Career and Technical Education Center in Park Forest and the South Central Illinois Training and Innovation Center in Litchfield. These partnerships forge higher-paying career paths for high school students while meeting the workforce needs of our employers. We have over 200,000 job openings in Illinois right now. This legislative session, let's explore every possible avenue to help businesses fulfill their workforce demands and give high school students a path forward to a good-paying job. Overall, Illinois now consistently ranks among the top 10 states in K-12 education quality and in higher education access. But even with Illinois' high school graduation rate at a 15-year high and eighth grade reading and math scores among the highest in the nation, we cannot take our foot off the gas in our efforts to equitably fund our schools. Despite the challenging fiscal environment, my budget proposal for this year prioritizes our state commitment to evidence-based funding and advances our effort to hire more teachers. I'm also proud to announce that entering its third year, our early childhood literacy program, in partnership with the Dolly Parton Imagination Library, has quickly expanded to 88 counties across Illinois. From the Austin neighborhood of Chicago to Pulaski County in southern Illinois, 97,000 children, birth to five, regardless of their family income, now receive free age-appropriate books in the mail every month. Reading literacy starts at home, and this program is working to make it easier for parents to give their kids a great start. For FY27, my budget proposal continues this program so that we can reach all 102 counties. Helping parents give their children the best possible upbringing is among my highest priorities as governor, and always has been. Everywhere I go, parents tell me one of their deepest concerns is the impact social media is having on their kids. It's a challenge unique to this generation, and it's made worse by the perverse incentive that social media companies seem to have to keep kids scrolling no matter what the cost to their physical and mental health. There's real harm being done, and it's interfering with our ability to give children the most productive educational environment possible. It's time to get cell phones out of the classroom. Working together, parents and teachers in school districts like Champaign and Springfield and Peoria prohibited cell phones in classrooms already. 25 states, including Florida, California, Texas, and New York, have done this with bipartisan support, and it's time for Illinois to follow suit. But we can do more. I'm proposing the Children's Social Media Safety Act, a common sense proposal to decrease the harmful effects of social media on kids, improve their safety and privacy online, and prevent financial scamming of children. This bill will put decisions about children's online safety back into the hands of parents, by allowing them more easily to restrict their kids' access on exploitative websites and apps. Social media algorithms have been proven to create mental health issues in adolescents and foster polarization and misinformation in society as a whole. Those companies are profiting from online engagement of Illinois' consumers, and they currently contribute nothing to ameliorate the negative effects of their platforms. So that I propose a social media platform fee that will generate $200 million per year to support K-12 education. Parents and kids deserve to have better funded schools. And if social media giants are going to feed off of Illinois families, they ought to support Illinois families. Our world is changing, and it seems like increasingly the benefits of those changes are reaped by a smaller and smaller group of people, while middle and working class Americans pay for it. Special interests and large corporations seem to delight in finding ever more insidious ways they're asked to rein in their worst abuses. Last year, after Illinois' insurance companies announced they'd be raising rates on Illinois homeowners by double digits, I demanded to have those companies justify the enormous rate increases. Every other state, except Illinois, has the power to do so. Consumers deserve to have proof of why their premiums are increasing at a rate far above inflation. So today, I'm calling on the House to pass HB 3799 that seeks from homeowners insurance companies a justification for material premium increases, a bill that has already been voted out of the Senate. Again, 49 other states have this reporting requirement. Illinoisans deserve nothing less. 1.5 million Illinois households could see their insurance bills go up by an average $750 this year. For most homeowners, this is nothing short of a crisis, and no one should claim that pursuing standard homeowner protections is an attack on business. This is about fairness and corporate responsibility to consumers. On a similar note, junk fees have crept into every aspect of people's lives, imposed by ticket sellers, rental companies, large tech companies, chain restaurants, and more. They're quietly nickel and diming Illinois families out of thousands of dollars per year. This session, I'm supporting legislation to ban such practices by requiring upfront full disclosure of all mandatory fees. It's about time for every Illinoisan to be able to take control and get the relief that they deserve. Now, I'm committed to doing everything government can to rein in the worst of the price gouging and profiteering that we're seeing. But I implore the titans of industry who regularly ask government to make their lives easier. What are you doing to make your employees and your customers' lives easier? It's a question that I'm committed to asking every CEO who shows up in Springfield looking for help. I hope you will ask them too. Before I became governor, I had a long career in business and I employed thousands of people. The vast majority of business owners are good people who want to do right by their employees, their communities, and their customers. Right now, everyday people are having trouble making ends meet, and we are all looking for ways to alleviate their burden. So it's time for every business to get in the game, step up to the plate, raise wages, and help lower the cost of living for Illinois families. A year ago, I stood before you and I asked a provocative question. After we have discriminated against, disparaged, and deported all our immigrant neighbors, and the problems we started with still remained, what comes next? Some of you walked out when I asked that question. But a year later, we have an answer, don't we? Masked, unaccountable federal agents with little training occupied our streets, brutalized our people, tear-gassed kids and cops, kidnapped parents in front of their children, detained and arrested, and at times attempted to deport U.S. citizens, and killed innocent Americans in the streets. Illinois was the canary in the coal mine for what we saw happen in Minnesota. It's a playbook as old as the game. Overwhelm communities, provoke fear, suggest that those tasked with enforcing the law are also above it, and drip authoritarianism bit by bit into our veins in the hopes that we won't notice we're being poisoned by it. The problem for Donald Trump and Stephen Miller was that Illinoisans did notice. Last year was not the first time a president has tried to subdue the Illinois population with hired thugs. In 1894, when the Pullman workers walked off their railroad jobs to protest a 25% cut in their wages, President Grover Cleveland, who at the time was serving the second of his two non-consecutive terms, deputized 5,000 U.S. Marshals and ordered Federal Guard troops into Blue Island to end the strike. On July 3, 1894, those marshals provoked a confrontation. Police Superintendent Michael Brennan described the federalized marshals in this manner. They were dangerous to the lives of the citizens on account of their careless use of pistols. They fired into the crowd of bystanders when there was no disturbance and no reason for shooting. A report from the Chicago Record newspaper read, "In regard to most of the deputy marshals, they seem to be hunting trouble all the time." Sound familiar? The strike fizzled after 25 people had been shot and killed, and many more wounded. But Governor Altgeld never forgot President Cleveland federalizing troops against Illinoisans. 6 months later, when he delivered his message to the General Assembly, Altgeld devoted fully half of those 60 pages to the events surrounding the Pullman strike. His anger at the federal government's overreach jumps off the page even 131 years later. If the president can, at his pleasure, send troops into any city, town, or hamlet, whenever and wherever he pleases, under the pretense of enforcing some law, his judgment, which means his pleasure being the sole criterion, then there can be no difference whatever in this respect between the powers of the president and those of the Tsar of Russia. If we have the courage to confront all of our past, it will inform a better future. I have joked with many of you that I wish I could spend just 1 year of my governorship presiding over precedented times. I yearn for normal problems. It was a conversation I had more than once with my friend, the late Governor Jim Edgar. Jim and I didn't share the same political party, but we did share something far more important, a fierce love of our country and our state. I've been thinking a lot lately about love, about loving people and loving your country and the power involved in both. Love is an affliction. It's the most fortifying of our emotions and the most debilitating. It refuses to ground itself in logic or reason. Its very existence enriches us, even though its presence always creates chaos. Love is a superpower. It teaches the brittle to bend. It shows the selfish how to share. It grants courage to the coward. Once sparked, love becomes momentum. It's the sled gathering speed down the hill. It's the drop of water as it tips over the falls. It's glitter out of a bottle. The bravest thing any of us will ever do in this life is to love without promise of reciprocation. Because love's ferocity does not dim with rejection. Try to banish love to a shadow, and it will only reach harder for the sun. I know right now there are a lot of people out there who love their country and feel like their country is not loving them back. I know that. I also know that love unrequited can break a heart made fragile by dashed hope, which is why it's important for me to stand before you today and tell you that your country is loving you back, just not in the way you're used to hearing. It's not speaking in anthems or flags or ostentatious displays of patriotism. It will never come from the people who say the only way to love America is to hate Americans. Love is found in every act of courage, large and small, taken to preserve the country we once knew. You will find it in homes and schools and churches and art. It is there. It has not been squashed. Over the last 12 months, I've heard love start to shout here in Illinois. I heard it from the bicyclers who showed up in Little Village every day during Operation Midway Blitz to buy out tamale carts so the vendors could return to the safety of their homes. I heard it from the parishioners who formed human chains around churches so that immigrants could worship. I heard it from the moms in the school pickup line who whipped out their cameras and their whistles. I saw it in every face of a Midwesterner who put on their heaviest coat and protested outside on the coldest day. I am begging my fellow politicians, my fellow Illinoisans, my fellow Americans, to realize that right now in this country, we are not fighting over policy or political party. We are fighting over whether we are going to be a civilization rooted in empathy and kindness, or one rooted in cruelty and rage. What you choose to arm yourself with in this fight, love or hate, exposes which side you are fighting on. Only the weakest of people believe that love is the weakest of weapons. And it turns out that love actually is all around, and that those who think that cruelty can destroy us are incapable of understanding the power of a nation moved by it. I love my country. I refuse to stop. The hope I have found in a very difficult year is that love is the light that gets you through a long night. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the great state of Illinois.
There you have it, Governor J.B. Pritzker's 8th State of the State Address and Budget Message. Rousing ovation of applause from the Illinois General Assembly right now, at least mostly on the Democratic side of the aisle for some of those talking points. Pritzker acknowledged the realities of budgeting in a precarious fiscal climate, driven in part by what he called the turbulence of Donald Trump.
Meanwhile, the president is making life harder and less affordable with tariff taxes on working families and small businesses. Trade wars devastating farmers, cuts to health care, food assistance, and education, imposing increased bureaucracy on states, lower job creation than any year since Trump's first term.
But Pritzker still had several new policy proposals, from changes in zoning regulation for new housing to placing fees on social media companies with users in Illinois and banning so-called junk fees and everything from food delivery to concert tickets. And there were repeat ideas from past years, too, including a statewide ban on cell phones in schools. And Pritzker, of course, once again called out the Trump administration, calling Illinois and Chicago the canary in the coal mine for the actions of immigration enforcement in Minneapolis. Joining us to talk through what we just heard are two experts on Illinois government, politics, and state finances. Brian Gaines is at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Paula Worthington, Senior Policy Advisor at the Civic Federation and Collaborating Scholar with the University of Illinois' Fiscal Futures Project. Brian, we need to pause in a couple of minutes for a station ID. We'll talk for about another 8 minutes or so here. But your initial reactions to the governor's speech?
I thought it was pretty skillful. I had mentioned I thought there'd be a mix of technical budget points for the experts listening and then a little bit of soaring rhetoric that can make its way to the general public, maybe secondhand from people and people watching the highlights. The lofty rhetoric about love at the end, we've just had Valentine's Day, and he took his cue from that. And frankly, I thought it mixed the anger at the Trump administration with a hopefulness that's a useful combination for a politician. I thought the budget matters were mostly small ball, and that makes sense in the climate we're in. So, I think he checked the boxes he wanted to check.
Paula Worthington, about a 40-second reaction from you, and then we'll pause for a station identification.
Sure. Thank you, Brian. I actually agree with Brian. I think the budget pieces were small, restrained, and sensitive to the moment, and it was really more of a political and social effort to make his case to Illinois and perhaps the rest of the country.
Illinois and perhaps the rest of the country, of course, because it seems obvious, although he has been coy about it, that Governor J.B. Pritzker is contemplating a run for president in 2028. And of course, the primary starts much earlier than that. All right, well, you are listening to live special coverage of Governor J.B. Pritzker's State of the State address and budget message to the Illinois General Assembly. We are going to pause briefly here for station identification, and then we will come back. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. All right, you're listening to live special coverage of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget message. Brian Gaines, talk more about that message of love at the end we heard there. I got to say, I've listened to many, many State of the State addresses, many State of the Union speeches. I do not hear the theme of love come up very often.
No, I think that was I said soaring rhetoric, and I didn't have that in mind. I thought that was a longer passage than usual. I'll give him credit as well for framing the whole thing around John Peter Altgeld, the governor from the 1890s. My old friend Jim Nolan, who's a big Altgeld fan, will have been pleased. He did relatively well tying current policies to policies from back then, and then he squared the anger at incompetence and worse from the Trump administration with his promise that Americans can harness love as a stronger power. He did everything except quote Albus Dumbledore from the Harry Potter books, I think. I don't know if he was quoting the movie Love Actually or the British band The Troggs when he said love is all around. But, he's a politician, and he wants to emphasize tone. And I think he didn't have big ticket budget points. I mean, he did a lot of small things. So the tone is probably more important to him here. And I think speechwriters, and he maybe he wrote a lot of it himself, worked hard on that. What's memorable about it was this combination of anger, but anger that is harnessed with this positive message as well.
Yeah, and it certainly goes at something that he was criticized for, at least among Republicans last year, which was being divisive and angry, as you noted there. This is a strikingly different tone. Paula Worthington, from a financial, fiscal perspective, you mentioned small, modest proposals here. The governor has claimed that this is his eighth balanced budget. What stood out to you among the various topics he pointed out in terms of state finances?
Well, he emphasized some of the planned proposed expenditure increases in terms of education and health and safety net services. That is very much aligned with the vision and the governor's priorities. He did not, of course, directly address inside the address itself how he's going to pay for those additional expenditures. And what I might just point out is that a quick look at the actual budget proposal documents, quickly zeroes in on a handful of what I will argue are relatively modest adjustments and what are often called revenue enhancements. So tweaking some elements of the corporate income tax with an effort to extend certain caps on operating loss deductions, changing the way the state raises taxes from casinos. The social media tax would be new, and that will, I'm sure, get a lot of attention. One other piece, not a big dollar amount, but I want to highlight it because it is sort of part of an ongoing story here, and that is that the proposal also includes a recommendation that the state lower the local government distributive rate, the amount of money that the state sends from its own income tax collections to local governments. And it's a relatively small decrease in the rate. There's a hold harmless provision to it, but I think it's illustrative of what happens when a state doesn't have a lot of buffer. It starts to look for quarters in the seat cushions. And
yeah,
so
I was just going to say, coins in the couch cushions. That's
right,
the exact metaphor that came to my mind.
Exactly. After the Great Recession, we saw the state cut back its direct support through that mechanism to local governments. You know, I do want to underscore and acknowledge, of course, the state provides meaningful support for local governments in other ways, obviously through its education support, through support for transit, as we saw we had before, but even with the reform acts that were passed at the end of last year. So it's not like the state does not support local governments. I would never say that. But I do think that's sort of illustrative of how the bean counters have to really look hard to find the dollars.
Indeed, and comes on top of the change in the grocery tax, where the state stopped collecting that on behalf of, or stopped imposing it, I should say, on behalf of local governments, many of which found that they had to vote themselves. Even we've spoken to politicians who were opposed philosophically to the tax, but felt that they had to do it for their own revenue situation. So the ball continues rolling downhill. We're going to have to leave it there. Paula Worthington, Senior Policy Advisor at the Civic Federation, Collaborating Scholar with the University of Illinois' Fiscal Futures Project, and Brian Gaines, Professor, the Honorable W. Russell Arrington Professor in State Politics for the University of Illinois System, based at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your analysis with us today on this live special broadcast of Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget address. You'll hear more coverage later today and tomorrow morning on this NPR station. That is it for us. Our program has been brought to you by the same team that brings you the 21st show, producers Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan, technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. For Illinois Public Media in the State Capitol Building, I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.